Hello and welcome to Ashes of the Imperium, a 40k podcast from sunny England. My name is Dan.
And I'm Steve.
Join us as we explore the 41st millennium in all its glory, as we talk narrative gaming, Warhammer lore, and awesome hobby. From the grim dark corners of Imperial hives
to the outer reaches of Xenos infested space.
Welcome to the Ashes of the Imperium.
Hello and welcome to Ashes of the Imperium. My name is Dan, and as ever, I'm joined by the wonderful Steve. How are you, Steve?
I'm good, but I'm a bit chilly, Dan.
A bit chilly? Why is that, Steve?
I don't know. Perhaps it's this ice death world we'll be visiting this week.
Have you been spending too much time dipping a toe into the Mirror Sea?
Yes, I think it's frozen my flip-flop.
When you stare in the Mirror Sea, do you see a hulking grotesque leviathan staring back? Is that a tyranny monster underneath, or is it just because it's the Mirror Sea?
Maybe it's both.
A little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. So yeah. We are exploring today the flashpoint, the third flashpoint. We may have skipped the second one, our bad, but we really enjoyed doing the first flashpoint, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And I think I suppose in some ways, and this is a good and a bad thing, the good thing is the flashpoints seem to be very different in how they're formulated. So we were kind of thinking the second one was going to be over in a couple of episodes, and we were kind of holding out to the end. And then obviously we ended up having a whole load of issues.
I think it was like 4 issues or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the good thing for me is that it means it won't be formula. And the new one that we'll be exploring here, we've kind of said, right, well, we don't know where it's going to go, but we don't want to get left behind. So let's kick off with Octarius.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do wonder whether there will be any more. But if there is a fourth, we may see whether there's a fourth and fifth and maybe combine them. But we'll see. As you say, there's no sort of formula for what does a flashpoint look like. And I like that, you know, I think that's quite a nice microcosm for Crusade in general. It's the fact that it doesn't have to be 2,000 points, line up on each side of the board and do the same old missions. You can kind of make it what you want. And I think certainly in the third issue, the most recent one, we've seen a real kind of change in style. There isn't a kind of flashpoint, you know, episode per se. There's just something called the Galactic War Hosts, which is all about specifically exploring High Fleet Leviathan, and it gives us some conversion ideas and some painting schemes, stuff like that, and we'll get onto that later. But Steve, what do you think overall about sort of the flashpoint over the kind of the two main issues plus the third one?
Yeah, I mean, I like it. I think in a way it's my favorite one yet, and compared to what we've had before, where we'd cover it would be in one sector, but it would actually be maybe two or three planets, and we'd get a theatre of war, maybe one or two per planet. So you kind of felt like you were just dipping your toe and skipping across these different places. Whereas so far, even just in these two issues, we've definitely spent more time on one location. And I think the other cool thing I think that really helps with Crusade is we've got the addition now of more kind of unique units. So we've got the Dark Krakens now, which is a Space Marine chapter. And I think for me, this just kind of says, hey, guys, you know, narrative play, crusade play, it's all yours. You know, go and explore it. Go and explore these planets that no one's ever heard of. And just given some really great examples of what some crazy games with avalanches and under the sea and all sorts of crazy stuff that, you know, you can pick and choose. But I think it's just showing the possibilities, and I think that's really exciting.
Absolutely. And I do quite like, whilst I won't be doing a Dark Kraken force myself, I did quite like their representation of them. They're kind of space wolfy in nature. They're a salamander successor, though, aren't they?
They are.
But they are somewhat kind of space wolfy in nature in the fact they're quite kind of, you know, tribal designs and, you know, sort of animal fetishes and stuff like that. So, and they daub their armor in this kind of bioluminescent paint, which I just think, certainly from a modeling perspective, there's enough out there, you know, enough bones and little gribbly bits that you can use from Space Wolf models or some Ideneth bits. You know, there's definitely scope for a really amazing characterful army there.
Yeah. And the fact that you can get, you know, fluorescence and luminescent paints, you know, in hobby pot size these days, would be great to give it a run over with the old infrared lamp and give it all, everything comes to life. And yeah, I really like it. I think it's great fun.
But for me, it's the Tyranids that are really grabbing my attention in this instance. Tyranids are an army that I have, listeners will know that I'm a big fan of. I'm very fond of them. But actually, I haven't played or done anything with Tyranids for quite some editions, really. I think I sold my army back in 7th. So I've always had been tempted to do something. But now having this this issue in front of me, it's really spurred on my enthusiasm. And actually, we'll get into it because it's the third issue that's done that the most, really. So we'll talk about the kind of two core issues, let's call them, because they are very much it's a kind of two separate battle scenes or sort of areas of fighting. It's really two kind of different styles of kind of theaters of war. And whilst it's set on one planet, clearly a planet is a huge thing, and there's a huge amount of variety that you can do. As Steve mentioned at the start, there is an ice planet. It's an ice death world, and part one is set in the Mirror Sea, and it's actually a not just like, naval battles up top. It's actually about like fighting underwater and in kind of not just in underwater research stations, but in and around them, fighting amongst the sea creatures. And it's got some cool rules about getting like hunted by, massive sea creatures, and not just like massive Tyranids that have been evolved to fight in undersea, but actually just kind of the rest of the megafauna.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's interesting that it's not necessarily explicit, but this is obviously designated a death world, so we obviously know that that's a dangerous place to live, but can't quite decide whether it's the fauna or the ice itself or a combination of them all. But the reason this is actually populated at all, and it's only got it says here 350 million population. This is a really cool description. It says made up of mostly of rugged frontiersmen, skinners, prospectors, loggers, hunters, ice pescid trawlermen, trappers, trackers, and miners. And these mines are actually Promethean seafloor extraction sites. Again, what would that look like? I mean, that sounds cool. So yeah, I think for me, all sorts of modeling and terrain possibilities here. But I think again, it's Death World. I really like the idea of this, that the actual, we'll explore in a minute the special rules for the just actually standing still on the planet are pretty cool too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think both the theater of war sets of rules are really quite interesting. So you've got beneath the mirrored sea, and then the second one is ice fields of the death of Ba'anzir. So we'll get onto the ice fields later, because that's what kind of part two is all about. But what did you think of the beneath the mirror sea rules, Steve? Do you think they're a good thematic representation of fighting underwater?
Yeah. So I mean, first of all, we've got restricted movement, which kind of makes sense because it's thicker to move through. So it's subtract 1 inch from move characteristics of units and subtract 2 inches from charge rolls. So yeah, that will make a difference and make everything a bit slower and a bit sluggish, which feels like you're under the sea. Modified weaponry. Each time an attack is made with a ranged weapon, halve the range characteristic to a minimum of 1. So again, your bolters are not going to be able to get out to reach out quite as far. And then we've got the super cool bit, which is Predators of the Deep. And I think for me, this is where you really kind of start having your crusade fun, because these are just random encounters that could make a big difference in a game, but it's actually really good fun. So at the start of each battle round, the player is taking the first turn, rolls a d6 on the following table and applies the results. So open water on a 1 is nothing. Flesh stripper swarms on a 2 or a 3. 4 or a 5 is octopod ambush, which I'll describe it. Emerging from hidden dens, these vast creatures ensnare prey with lashing tentacles, dragging them back into their lairs to be devoured. So again, we're just getting that Death World vibe again. And then if you roll a 6, you get that gargantuan carcassaur. These creatures are thought to be by many a myth. With bodies many hundreds of meters long, even the largest war machines can be swallowed whole if they are too slow to avoid their vast lunging maws. So
that's amazing. essentially you work out the model on the, or units on the battlefield with the highest total wounds characteristic, that is the total cumulative wounds characteristic of all the models in the unit. So if two or more units are tied, you randomly determine, and essentially this gigantic sea creature goes hunting after that. It's like an apex predator, so it goes after the thing with the most wounds. The player whose army that unit is from rolls 2d6. If the total is greater than the unit's unmodified move characteristic, for each point that the total exceeds that unit's unmodified move characteristic, that unit suffers d3 mortal wound for each point.
So if you've got a big blob of Terminators, could be really painful, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's. Imagine if you, like, roll boxcars on that, double six, on, like, a slow unit.
Oh, but it's rare. A lot say most people think it's a myth, but
yeah,
that arrived to
come wrong, eh?
So I think for me, again, I love these as much as anything else. That, you know, if you wanted to play a slightly different Death World, you know, you could still take those ideas and bring them across. You know, there could be some sort of death mole that comes out from under the ground and eats you, or, you know, so I think
that is the least scary thing that you could have thought of, Steve. Like, of all that, you've got like gargantuan carcharosaurs, you've got octopods, death like, mole.
Like, if we had a star nose death mole.
A death mole. What's this, like Wind in the Willows after dark?
it's the school friendly version.
Death mole. Oh, Steve, what would you rather face on a 2-3, the flesh stripper swarms, or the death mole?
The death mole. Yes, okay. So I am going to have
to draw. Or the Inja Weasel. I was about to start talking about ways in which you could model the flesh stripper swarms or the octopod ambush, but now I'm just imagining like your table looking like something out of The Animals of Farthingwood.
Yes, just swap the rhinos for tractors and we'd be sorted.
There we go. But yeah, it does provide you with some amazing opportunities to, you know, not only build some terrain, but also build some markers for the octopod ambush, or maybe you could build, you know, use some, you know, Tyranid tentacles or something like that, or something out of a chaos thing that's got tentacles, like some of the possessed. I think they've got some crazy tentacle arms. You could just have some tentacles coming out of that terrain to represent the fact that some things are octopods and they're going to come for you. So not only does this predator of the deep rule exist at the start of the battle round, yeah, as you say, you roll a d6, but you can also, you know, make up your own terrain rules and just say, you know, this is an octopod. This is an octopod cave. So not only do you have the Predators of the Deep rule that happens, but you could also say every single time you make a move while within 3 inches of this terrain piece, you roll, you know, that it counts as on a four up, it counts as an octopod ambush, and that same thing happens.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. You make it more dangerous. A deadly death world, perhaps.
A super death world.
Super death world. Super death world full max extreme plus.
Death moles.
I will do the movie poster for Death Mole.
We did talk about terrain in a previous episode when we were talking about submersed terrain, weren't we? Or partially submersed terrains, so like ruins who are kind of on a flooded environment. But this kind of takes it one step further. So it's all well and good playing in a flooded city, because you can just, you know, slightly submerge your cities of death type ruins and you know, maybe use some water effects around it. But how would you model an underwater board if you were going to play in that kind of environment, Steve?
I guess, you know, you kind of feel that like a normal seabed, which is usually flat, but that sounds a bit dull. I mean, if there is promethium being mined under it, so obviously we can have some mining equipment. Maybe we could have some sort of vents, some heat vents or something. So we could have like the thermal vents that we have here on planet Earth, the deep sea where there's all sorts of creatures live around them, you know, away from the sun's light and warmth. But again, I think, you know, who knows how big things are. So, you know, we can find, you know, on eBay, you know, corals and things like that. I did do an Age of Sigmar table, and I've actually got, it's really, really old. I think it must be pushing 18 years old. And like about, I don't know, 10% of the pixels don't work, but this old projector. But what I worked out is that I put it on a stepladder. I pointed it down at the table and then just put my laptop in it. I actually got the ripply kind of water effects you get on the seabed, where you get those kind of, and I projected that onto the table. That looked cool. It was a bit dark. It was a bit dark, and you couldn't read your spore scrolls. But yeah, those little details, details.
No, that does sound pretty cool.
I think the other thing in this issue that I kind of missed first time round is that although our theatre of war is under the sea, Flashpoint mission covers a really cool thing. So it's a, you know, it's a battle plan. It's a mission of what to play. But what it covers is the fact that, and this for me starts to show maybe more intelligence than you sometimes think of. When it comes to Tyranids, just because we just think of them as this mass swarm, but there's a native creature called an Ursan wolf that lives on the planet, and the Ursan wolves, they know how to track humans. They know the planet. They know they're literally, you know, wolves of the ice world. So early on in the conflict, the Tyranids want to hunt down the wolves to take on their biomass and genetic code so that they can learn it themselves. And this mission is all about the Dark Kraken forces looking to protect the dens, the wolf dens. And that, for me, is kind of a really different twist than this just endless kind of swarm of nids. This is very much a tactical strike. This is, it's definitely something that they're, and I think for me that we've got some really cool, we've got the usual thing, control one or two marker, objective markers, control three or more. So we've got some cool rules in there that absolutely make sense. But things like, we've got rules like cornered beasts. So at the start of each battle round, each player rolls 4d6 for each unit of their army that is within range of an objective marker. Objective marker equals den. For the each roll of a one, you suffer a mortal wound. So the wolves are going to protect themselves, anyone that comes near them. So in a way, you kind of say, well, the Marines are going to, you know, form a barrier. They might get scratched by the wolves at their back, kind of keep them out, but they've got to protect the gene code. So again, another cracking, you know, piece of rules and background all combined together into something you can use in your games.
Yeah, I love these Crusade missions. They're just really characterful and allow you to, just as we said before, like play something that's just like slightly different.
Yeah.
Like for a little bit of variety. And even the deployment zones are quite funky. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Not only can you play some, you know, very different missions, but also they're specifically designed for Crusade. So, for example, the victor bonus in this Ursan Wolves Den mission is, if this battle was a Crusade battle, the victor can select two units from the army to be marked for greatness after the battle instead of just one. So it's designed specifically to go hand in hand for Crusade. But clearly, if you're just playing, you know, this could be anything. These could be, you know, satellite relays that the Tau are trying to intercept on a, you know, Astra Militarum base instead of dens. You know, you can just use mechanically, you can use the same thing, and maybe the damage that happens if you're near the objective is to do with, you know, leaking radiation or something from the satellite relays. You can tweak the mechanics to work for you. But I just think it's a really nice way of keeping your games really varied, so it isn't just, as I say, like 2K versus 2K, you know, on the other side of the board.
100%. And I think the nice thing as well is that if you've got a group of mates that normally play, you know, matched, sometimes the idea of going all in on Crusade and narrative, and it's like, oh, it's all getting a bit made up, oh, blimey, I'm not comfortable. Because you've got a GW set of rules here, it kind of gives the daftness some credibility and something that they can understand and kind of go, okay, I see that's crazy, and I can see it's written in such a way that, you know, from turn four, blah, 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 I can read that. And I think that's the other good thing for this. This becomes then a much easier in for people into narrative play.
Definitely. So moving on to the second episode of Flashpoint Octarius, we're going to be now talking about the Ice Fields of the Death of Banzir, or Banzir. So whilst the previous one was all about kind of subsurface activity and a bit of Ursan Wolf shenanigans, this one is all about the kind of the ice flows, and it revolves around a large fortress being constructed by the Mechanicum, and ultimately the High Fleet closing in on the inhabitants of the planet. These rules are quite interesting and represent, I think, the kind of swirling ice storms and the instability of the ice flows. So for every time a unit advances or charges, for each dice result of a 1 or 2, that unit suffers 1 mortal wound. So no extra dice to roll, but just when you do roll that dice, if you roll a 1 or 2, you suffer a mortal wound. And again, another ranged attack tweak. Each time a ranged attack is made, if the attacker is more than 24 inches from the target, a hit roll of 1 to 4 fails, irrespective of any abilities that the weapon or the model making the attack may have. Now, I think some of these rules really benefit Tyranids in that they want to get up nice and close. So the fact that ranges are being impacted, then that's brilliant. But obviously, Tyranids do want to get up and close, and they are a close combat army. So that's nicely, I think, balanced by the fact that if you roll 1s or 2s when advancing and charging, which Tyranids want to be doing lots of, then they're suffering potentially a penalty there for through mortal wounds. So I think it isn't just like completely one-sided for the Tyranids.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, you know, why is this an interesting battle to pick on when there are thousands of planets at war within the sector? Might be more than thousands, that's a total guess. But there's a lot of planets, so why pick a certain planet to look at? Well, let's look at the ones where, yeah, it's not just a long-range firing line keeping them at bay, because it's not a lot of fun to play, is it?
No. And in the previous Flashpoint, because it was set underwater, the theatres of war, there we go, he says, checking back, the theatre of war is set underwater. There was specifically a designer's note that says, you know, it's probably best you don't use aircraft in this. Whereas on this one, your aircraft, you probably want to be having lots of aircraft or units that can fly, because they really benefit against the kind of the main part of this theatre of war. So the rule here is devastating avalanches. And so at the start of the first battle round, the player who is taking the first turn randomly determines one battle edge that is not a player's battlefield edge, i.e. one of the sides,
yep.
rather than the kind of one of the left or right sides or on the front and back, to be the avalanche battle edge. And at the start of each battle round, the avalanche covers more of the battlefield in crushing snow and ice, as shown in the example diagram below. And there's a little kind of diagram, as you can imagine. At the start of the second battle round, all units, excluding units that can fly, in Avalanche Zone 1 suffer D6 mortal wounds. However, until the end of the battle, units, excluding aircraft units, in Avalanche Zone 1 gain the benefit of light cover and heavy cover. However, every part of the battlefield in that zone has the difficult ground terrain trait. So you get D6 mortal wounds in Avalanche Zone 1. That's after the second battle round. In the third battle round, exactly the same thing. It goes into zone 1 and 2, and you get D3 wounds. And that way, zone 2 gets light cover and heavy cover and difficult ground. And then finally, at the start of the fourth battle round, all units, again, except units that can fly, in Avalanche Zones 1, 2, and 3, suffer 1 mortal wound. And so that's it. It doesn't just, like, you know, continue going forever. Obviously, you'd run out of turns as well. So essentially, you've got a 24-inch kind of side part of the board, so nearly half the battlefield, where you could be suffering, you know, 10 mortal wounds if you roll poorly. So you get D6, D3, and plus 1. So, you know, that's enough to be getting on with, really, isn't it?
It'd make a mess of quite a lot of things, especially being mortals as well. And it's a good excuse to get cotton wool out, isn't it? Have a big, long stream of it being like the rolling, frothy beginning, the front of the wave of the avalanche. So that would look cool on the table, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure cotton wool on the table looks cool ever. It just looks like like something's gone a bit crazy. But I do think it would be quite the opportunity to, model, like, you know, when you see like clumps of rocks, you know, like kind of rocky outcrops and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You could get like quite a lot of those. And just kind of dot them all around, just to kind of break up the terrain or whatever. But obviously that does have line of sight implications. But hey, it's Crusade, so you do what you want.
Exactly. So you mentioned the fact that we've got this kind of this new part of the planet that we're exploring, and this really cool citadel that's being completed. It isn't finished. It's called Glacialix. It's being made by the Mechanicus. And basically, it's going to end up being kind of a fortress, last stand place. And again, we get some really cool order of battles. We get, you know, who's there, including, and we get introduced this time, some Kill Team Death Watch units.
Yeah, so Kill Team Galliel is something that they've even got rules for. So you've got a data sheet in there, and they kind of really kind of go quite deep into, you know, how you can, you know, they're involved in the story as well, in the kind of the narrative story. And yeah, it's got this whole kind of strategic disposition of Watch Fortress Eye of Octos on Death of Bianzir. So it tells you, like, whether, you know, who you've got. You've got like a sergeant of the Revilers, and you've got a sergeant from the Dark Angels and things like that. And it just kind of goes into all this detail. So you can, if you do want to go kind of slightly more, you know, historically accurate, let's say, you can really kind of use this as an example.
Yes, I'm totally intrigued by this. I really like this. And again, you know, you get to see little cool rules that it's like, why are they there? What's their specialty? You know, why have they been called in? Well, they get an ability called Hunters in the Darkness, which is each time a model in this unit makes a ranged attack, you can ignore any or all rules that will reduce the maximum range of weapons this model is equipped with. So if you're fighting in the sea, if you're fighting in an ice storm, because you are trained to deal and fight in the darkness, yeah, no problem. I can shoot wherever I like. So again, that's why they're here. They're here because they're suited for this environment. In the same way, Tyranids are here, and I'm going to introduce, I think, one of the bits you're excited about. Flying Nids do really well on this planet.
They do, they do. More on which later. although it's interesting, so the Swirling Ice Storm, each time a ranged attack is made, more than 24 inches from the target, a hit roll of 1-4 fails, irrespective of any abilities that the weapon or the model making that attack may have. So, yes, your range isn't being reduced. However, the to-hit penalty that the Swirling Ice Storm gives wouldn't, you wouldn't kind of ignore that.
You'd just be good under the sea.
Yes, yeah, Hunters in the Darkness. Or in any kind of, you know, you're playing night fighting type rules and you've agreed that, you know, you've got -6 range or whatever it is.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, so I think for me, we'll get to our Crusade lists for this Warzone. But I think for me, this whole idea that we've got, as always, we've got all these great little snippets that are dropped in. I just want to pick up some of the names. Tylonian Glacier Guard, they appear in the rosters. The Valkyrie 419th, the Sky Daggers. We get some Mordian Iron Guard here. Some Hyancine Long Guns, the 422nd. They're really interesting, and they may well join it because they're known for the use of the Hydra, and that'll make a bit more sense in a minute. But I think for me, it's just these really cool regiment names, and we're told that there's at least a dozen regiments on this planet alone trying to hold back the Tyranid invasion. So I think, you know, it's so easy just to go, oh, right, so if I use those models and this head and make sure they've got this kit, you know, you can really kind of bring the story to life in the models that you use.
Yeah, these little snippets, these narrative snippets, we're a big fan of, aren't we, Steve? They always give you the inspiration just in a couple of lines, being able to explore things a bit further, which, whilst it wasn't a couple of lines, it was a couple of paragraphs, that's certainly where my inspiration for my Crusade army started. So I was going to focus on the Erinyai, so all about flying Tyranids. But Steve, do you want to run us through yours first?
Yeah, so something that I kind of got kicked off by the original story, and if you've not heard our Kill Team episode, of course you should, but also we cover off kind of why Octarius is such a focus at the moment, and that was down to Inquisitor Crypman deciding that it'd be a really good idea to take a massive horde of orcs and send High Feet Leviathan there to go and eat them all, which sounds okay in itself. However, of course, you end up with this huge fighting force that just wants to fight and get stronger when it fights in the orcs. And we've got this other force, which is all about eating biomass and getting genetic diversity and power, and they two crush each other. And basically, they've just made each other worse. So we've got this huge mincing machine in the middle. So the Inquisition kind of got it wrong, or Cryptman at least got it wrong. So my idea was, and we're definitely getting this in the rules, is that we are seeing the impact. What does a new creature that's got orc genetic material in it? So my idea is I wanted to have an Inquisitor of me very own, and I've called him Xavier Serrano. He's Ordo Xenos, as you'd expect, and he's a psyker. Now, I'm going to give his job is, and it's a good reason for me to go from planet to planet. If we go from planet to planet in this, we don't know. He doesn't know what his orders are yet either. So, but it's to go and collect samples of these new evolved creatures, these new Tyranid creations. But what I didn't want him to do particularly was to rock up with a massive
inquisitorial entourage of all this, like, you know, all the different things that you might expect or you might read about in the Black Library models.
Exactly. Rather. Yes. So yes. So no weaponsmith, no, none of that stuff. So he's going to come with the two acolytes, which are going to be basically, they'll fight as acolytes, but they're going to be kind of scribes or kind of servitor scripts. So which were and they're basically there to record what he finds. So they'll still fight. But what I want to do is I want to kind of tell his story as we go through, and I'm going to build his retinue. That's the word I was searching for. Build his retinue from the other units that fight with him. So to start with, he's going to arrive on Bayonzir, and he's going to basically rock up, see a company commander from the Astra Militarum, and say, "You're coming with me. I want two of your best units, and we're going to go on a mission, and we're going to go and capture some of this stuff. Whether it's going to be alive or not, you know, alive is a bonus. And I think for me, that's a modelling challenge: is what does it look like? But I think I'll leave that for another episode. So my list is an Inquisitor that's a psyker. He's got two acolytes, which are these recorders, a company commander, two units of 10 veterans. So these are like the best of the best. And to ensure that everything goes to plan, there's going to be a commissar that comes with them. So there's going to be kind of an elite unit that the company commander will say, right, you're coming with me. We're going with the Inquisitor. And they're going to have a chimera to kind of load up the what they find on it,
like a flatbed chimera rather than a true transport.
Yes, a low loader. Yeah. So, and again, I think for me that's kind of I imagine I'd play a few games with this, and what actually, you know, if the commissar cops it, doesn't make it through, fails, no, he doesn't make the retinue. Maybe it's the company commander, maybe he does amazing things and survives a huge attack. And eventually, and the Inquisitor says, right, I'm going to the next planet. I'm not taking you all, but the company commands that becomes part of the retinue. So what we do is we'd end up at the end of the campaign with this group of people with the Inquisitor, where you'd look at it and go, why have you got one Bulgrin? And why have you got one of those? And why is there just... And there would be a reason, because they've excelled in a battle. They've earned their place.
Oh, you could do, like, the units that you mark for greatness, they could become part of the retinue.
Yes, exactly. So I had a test game with the Inquisitor, me and Rob Moore, and it didn't do so great, but what we did allow, because it was a narrative game, is that there was a medic nearby, part of my command squad, and the medic got him back up on his feet. For me, that would be a great example that this isn't for Xavier, this was a different one, but I think for me that's a great example that it's like, right, you're now my personal medic, you're staying with me, because the Inquisitor has the power to you know, to requisition whoever he needs. So yeah, that's my starting force.
Oh, love it. So tell us a little bit about your Inquisitor. Is he a kind of, he sounds like a bit of a kind of academic scribe type Inquisitor, rather than a kind of kick-ass guy that's going to be wandering around in Terminator or Power Arm or something like that. He sounds more like an academic.
No Terminator armor. I think he's handy enough, otherwise he wouldn't have made it this far, but he's certainly, you know, the upgrades that I'll give him won't be, you know, fighting abilities. It will be the ability, you know, it's for him to do his job better. So yeah, absolutely. His glory will be to add to the bible of, you know, NID species types. And I think for me, it then opens up opportunities for some modelling, which we can talk about in a bit.
Awesome. And then what about your veterans? What do you see them being armed with?
So I think these are locals. And so I think they're going to be, haven't decided which ones they're there's the Trushkan Snowhounds. That sounds pretty cool. I guess, you know, it's things like, you know, could the Trushkan Snowhounds actually have an Ursun wolf with them? You know, it's like a pet.
They've tamed it or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that would be cool. That would be cool to add. It doesn't have to be huge, massive dire wolf. Just your regular wolf would do. But I see them then like in snow kit. They're not carrying a heavy weapon. I mean, there's no way you're dragging a las cannon around in the snow. Maybe a heavy bolter, but otherwise, yeah, flamers for sure. Certainly want to toast the NID swarms that are coming towards us. And, you know, we still need a bit of melter. We've still got to be able to deal with the big ones as well. I'm not necessarily thinking they are specialist monster hunters. I think maybe that's a character we could bump in later on, because obviously that we've already been told that the locals are pretty sparse, not that many on the size of the planet that we have. So, or maybe one of those, you know, if suddenly you've got, there's a dude with a lasgun that manages to take that last wound off the Morlock. Well, suddenly he gets remodeled with a, you know, super heavy lasgun sniping rifle, hunting rifle with bandoliers on him, and then he becomes part of the retinue. I think that's I think they start off as just good solid veteran troops that know how to fight on this planet, but those that survive, those that get through this ordeal, those are the ones that could end up becoming, and maybe they'll end up two units will end up being one unit, and they become a kind of little piece of history in themselves. So I think that's the fun of it, and let the game decide.
Love it. I think it's really cool.
So what about you, Dan? How have you approached your force?
So I was, as I said, inspired by the Arinyai, who are essentially some like a force of a nickname given to a kind of force of flying Tyranids that plagued all the flying elements of the Imperial forces on the in the Flashpoint. So I was actually not disappointed. Yeah, sorry, I was disappointed. I was disappointed because a lot of the things that I had in my mind didn't actually exist anymore. So there used to be some really cool, characterful units in Tyranid codexes of yesteryear. So there used to be a flying special character called the Parasite of Mortrex, which had like a kind of sting thing that implanted ripper things in you, and you'd then explode, and people would explode and turn into rippers, which is quite fun. And you used to be able to get things called shrikes, which were flying Tyranid warriors. So given that this is Crusade, I think that if I was kind of going fully into this as a narrative Crusade thing, I think I would definitely be having a conversation with my opponents about whether I could, let's say, use the old rules for shrikes and work out, you know, maybe it's one extra power level or two extra power levels on Tyranid Warriors, and working out what would be an appropriate war scroll to use, and perhaps making up my own one for the Parasite of Mortrex. But instead, I wanted to focus on what does exist, just so we could kind of stick to the kind of confines of the publications available to us at the moment. So my kind of the brief was that everything needs to have wings. So that does limit me somewhat, but I did look to Forge World for some existing stuff. So the first thing is we have some Sky Slasher Swarms. So those are two power, and you get three swarms, and these are basically just flying rippers. So that's nice and cool. And then I went for two squads of gargoyles.
Yeah.
So for three power level each, you get 10 gargoyles. So 20 in total. And they're kind of like make up the bulk of my force. And then the next units, I went for a harpy and a hive crone. So you might be thinking, oh, there's no HQ in there. And you'd be right. So the total power level for that is 24. I thought it was quite cool to do that and have, you know, two kind of a harpy and a hive crone, because a hive turret with wings is 11, But then I think that kind of that took up quite a lot of my force. And I did think that at the early stages, then perhaps a Hive Tyrant, you know, a Hive Tyrant's a big deal, right? In the 41st millennium.
Yes.
I think it's like, you know, like Space Marine Chapter Master type level. And I just felt that maybe like 25 power, whether that would be the best thing. I don't know. What do you think?
Be a bit of a handful against whoever's going to fight you, wouldn't he?
And I suppose harpies and high crones are, you know, they're chunky monsters, aren't they?
Yeah, they're not
to be
chickens.
Sniffed at.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think it makes sense, and I think you build up to it, don't you? You build up to it that these are the initial scouting units, or these are the ones that have got a sniff. Oh, there's another creature which I really like the name of. It was so these are obviously on the ice and snow plains. Megalocurious. Sound like really, I don't know, but they sound cool. So again, you know, perhaps they are literally, they sound, if they're in a herd, it sounds like they're a big thing. So they're kind of sort of meals on legs. They're massive sort of places. So again, if you were like a sort of tentacle that's gone out from the main force to go and, you know, check out these herds and see what they are, then yeah, you wouldn't, the Hive Tyrant wouldn't go on such a job. He would be busy herding and calculating. And so yeah, and if we're trying to follow the herds and see what happens, and suddenly we meet, well yeah, I mean, who knows what a sky slasher swarm looks like after it's had a few orcs for dinner, you know. So again, I think it works really well. I think it works later, and it would look great on the battlefield, or just flying in, especially flying above all of the avalanche. Cheeky monkey.
Yeah, exactly. I've just done a bit of tweaking on the list, and you could do a Hive Tyrant with wings, two units of gargoyles, and a harpy. And obviously, you could do slashers. Mm. You know, you swap one of those gargoyles for sky slashers. That's 25 power. So a Hive Tyrant, 20 gargoyles, and a harpy or a hive crone, whichever one, because they're both the same. I just feel like that's quite overkill for 25 power. So a Hive Tyrant with wings would undoubtedly be the next expansion, let's say. You know, if we were going to go up 50 power, that would absolutely make sense to throw in some additional units and a Hive Tyrant, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, that's where, you know, if we're storytelling, our first clash with you at 25 power level, oh my God, everything flies. You get the Hive Tyrant. I'm going to go over and knock on the door of the Hyannis long guns and say, I'm commandeering that Hydra, chop, chop. So yeah, I think it's, I think for me, that's a fun way to play the game, I think. And also because you're talking about it and sharing the story together, it's not just, you know, what are you bringing? I won't tell you what I'm bringing, and I'll just bring something to break you, because I've brought all the toys that fight you. You know what I mean? That the game can evolve. And hey, if I get smashed for two games in a row, then there's going to be some heroes out of that will end up becoming part of my retinue. So that's great storytelling as well. And I'm still going to get marked for greatness. So someone's still going to come out, you know, with a bonus somewhere. And I think that's how you build those characters.
So I'm just toying with some things. So Tyranid Warriors are 4 power level. And I think, you know, should we call them 5 power level for fly ones? Do you think that would be appropriate?
Yeah.
And just like looking at all the units, you're just like, what would flying versions of all these things look like?
Yes.
Yeah. Or maybe like one of the things I considered was...
Ooh, flying gene stealers. Ow.
Oh, yeah. I might have a look at that and see what gene stealers look like with gargoyle wings or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just think like a full flying army would be pretty cool.
Ooh.
You know, the scope to go all in and add a Harridan in the end.
They are so cool.
And plus, one of my favourite models from a previous range was the Forge World Hive Tyrant with wings. So it was in the old style of Hive Tyrant, when they looked more like the aliens, the Xenomorphs aliens from the film Alien.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of that kind of style. So yeah, if I do expand it beyond 25. I think I would quite like to to do this army to 25 power, because it would allow me to do Tyranids after kind of not doing them for so long. There's a bunch. It's unique, and I wouldn't want, you know, would I want to have a whole 100 power of flying Tyranids? You know, maybe not, but could I do it for a small 25 power little force? I think, yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the benefits of Crusade is you can kind of explore all these crazy little ideas and just keep it to 25 power.
Yeah, and I think the cool thing is you're, even though, you know, something that's, you know, you can't always imagine as being that varied in that they all kind of come from these blueprints, but even if you ended up with a larger force of which only 25 power level was flying, that's the genetic material that you picked up from Bayan Zee, and that's why they're part of this army. And that other part of the army is because they came from a different planet, and they, which was, and I think for me, you know, there are scars and stories to tell even within Tyranids, which you, and I think that's cool.
Yeah, I'm now just considering all the different options, and like, and even things like Venomthropes and Zonthropes and stuff, like more Venomthropes. Yeah. But you could give them wings, and there's a, like, what I think what really got me was in the third batch, as I said, it's this article called Galactic War Hosts, and it isn't actually a kind of Crusade article in itself, in like the kind of traditional Flashpoint, as we said. It's just a deep dive into High Fleet Leviathan. It's got some cool alternate paint schemes, and this is something which I really do like. So it talks about splinter fleets. So High Fleet Leviathan clearly has its traditional color scheme, which is like the box art scheme of the kind of bony colored shaded with kind of pinky purple, and then the purple chitin. But it says here you could paint the skin darker to represent your army fighting on a night world, or the carapace brighter to help them blend in with the snow. Markers or carapace patterns are a great way to indicate particular splinter fleets or swarms. Consider experimenting with contrast paints on the flesh areas for really quick results. So it just kind of shows you all these different tweaked versions of the High Fleet Leviathan scheme that you can, you know, you can be like, yeah, it's still a High Fleet Leviathan, but it's totally mine. And it has really inspired me to kind of be like, okay, cool. Well, I don't necessarily need to do a box art army, but I can still, because I do like to anchor it within an existing lore.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I mean, it's very cool. And even down to, we've actually got some relics, Crusade relics. And if you look at one of those, there's a thing called Ice Flow Hide. Tyranid unit only. Bioengineered to protect against extreme cold, this creature's hide has a rubbery texture, allowing it to deflect even the sharpest blades. Each time the bearer would lose a wound from a melee attack, roll 1d6. On a 5+, that wound is not lost. How cool is that?
That is cool. Love it.
There's a really cool one to go with my Death Watch, which I might well be joining me for my second choice, which is Beast Bane, ornate bolt pistol carried by Death Watch brother Carius of the Scythes of the Emperor during his service on the death of Bayan Zee. Even after his death, its machine spirit remains imprinted with its loathing of all Tyranid bioforms. So it has to be carried by a Death Watch model.
Sounds like you're tailoring your army to beat me already, Steve.
I just found it lying around. Some poor dude died. The relic replaces the bolt pistol. It is a heavy bolt pistol, mastercrafted specialist, and has the following profile. So it's 12-inch, pistol 2, strength 4, AP minus 2, damage 2, and special service, special issue ammunition. Each time an attack is made with this weapon against the Tyranid, ooh, sorry, Dan, add 1 to the attack wounds roll. So it's still 12-inch pistol, but it's cool. It's going to create some cool moments, isn't it, where I can just 2 shots, take those last 2 or 3 wounds off, and, yeah, the creature falls out of the sky and lands at the feet of the Inquisitor or the, obviously, Death Watch sergeant that's holding it. So, again, I think for me it's just these, what we see with Crusade is it's that combination of theatres of war, specialist rules just for that planet, its unique missions that give it extra, and now we've got relics. So I'm hopeful we'll get some more, who knows, from Octarius, because we haven't really seen any of the other Crusade rules that we would get.
No, and but we also haven't seen the Octarius kind of campaign book either yet, have we?
Yes. Oh, desperate for that. Or even an Octarius mission pack.
I think that's what I meant. Yeah, mission pack. Yeah, but Beyond the Veil type thing.
Yeah, but we've also had Book of Rust and stuff as well, which have been...
Oh, wait a minute, no. So yeah, mission packs are the little diddy ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the Book of Rust is like the big campaign books. Yeah, either of those would be cool.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think for me, some people have, somebody asked me about one of the mission packs and they said, oh, it felt a bit light. I said, yeah, the initial part of the book feels like, oh, I've just, you know, where's the story elements coming to life? But no, you have to read the rest of the book because there's so much more in the missions, like the Wolf Den one I described earlier, that are rules for that mission that absolutely bring that planet to life, bring that war zone to life. So, yeah, no, I love them.
So my favourite model of the in the Galactic War Hosts is the converted Trigon. So it's meant to be a Hive Tyrant, and it's by a guy called Luke Blick, and he's essentially given wings to Trigon and converted the head and used Hive Tyrant weapons. And I just think it's really cool. And I think if I did that, I wouldn't necessarily run it as a Hive Tyrant because I think the four-draw model and in fact the Games Workshop model was just too cool not to use. But you could totally add it into your flying army and just be like, you know, the wings represent, you know, because clearly Trigons and Morlocks burrow. You could just say, instead of it coming up from underneath the ground, you could say it's swooping down from the sky and you could just represent it like that.
100%. That's a great idea. I think it's... I mean, I think for me, the fact that the creature itself has got quite such a big chest area, I suppose you call it a chest, and it's articulated waist, isn't it? So the chest area, it just looks like it's got the musculature to actually flap those wings as well. So I think...
Oh, totally, yeah.
I think if it was on... If the wings were on the bottom bit, which is, you know, from the hips, it's got no legs, but you know what I'm saying, from the waist down, it would look a bit strange. It's like the wings would... It would all fall over, but... But no, and I think the article as well has got my juices going because there's a really cool bit about converting orcs into Gene Stealer orc hybrids.
Oh, yeah. And these are something that existed way back when, wasn't it? In sort of Rogue Trader era.
Yes. Yeah. And I think for me, I really like the fact that they've actually broken it down. They've shown you a picture of them complete, but they've actually broken it down and told you which parts to get from the Acolyte hybrids, the Orc Commandos, and the aberrants, and giving you the part numbers and what cuts you need to make to put them together. And they're not complicated, you know, it's not, you know, hours of green stuff and all that. It wouldn't be that difficult to put together. And it's crazy, actually, they've swapped some of the legs, one of the legs over. And even though it's like literally half the size, it still looks creepy and weird. It looks like, and I think because the legs kind of back, you could imagine this thing kind of dragging. It's kind of
kind of zombie mummy type, you know,
just dragging this withered leg along with it. So yeah, no, I my challenge, I think, is, you know, what does a captured orc hybrid, you know, could we capture one? Is the first question. And then if we could probably get a dead one, okay, so how do I model a dead one? Or if we capture a live one, how do I keep that, you know? Because I think if we've got this pickup Chimera transport vehicle, maybe it's not necessarily like, you know, a flatbed full of body parts. Maybe it's got refrigeration tanks and cylinders with...
I mean, you could just go old school and do have like a prison truck, you know, like the like how Arya rescues that that bloke in Game of Thrones from the back of the cage. People will be like, don't call him that bloke, his name is blah 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 blah. You know, the faceless man, you know, what's his name?
Yeah.
We literally got people shouting at their phones at the moment, or Darius be like, it's this. Yeah. sorry, my bad. But yeah, you could have like that, or you could have, so you know how in like the Lost World they bring back the spoilers, they bring back a Tyrannosaurus, that would make that film amazing, but they bring back a Tyrannosaurus Rex on the boat in like the hatches. You could open, you could have like a, you could get sort of just make the hatches larger and kind of have it open and have it almost like penned in or like tied down.
Yeah. I think for me that again, just adding that to your existing army, and then you're using it as a, you know, use it as a normal chimera for a regular game with somebody, and they go, what is that? You know, what are you doing with that? And you've suddenly got a great story to tell that ties in with the whole lore, and it'd be great fun to do rather than doing just another chimera.
Exactly. I've just realised, having done some searching on the internet whilst you're talking about some, you know, I was looking for like flying Tyranid models. I realised there used to be, back in the day, in 7th edition, a formation called the Skyblight Swarm. And it was a Hive Tyrant, a Hive Crone, 2 Harpies, and 3 Gargoyle Broods.
Wow.
So that is ideal, isn't it? To kind of base my army around that.
Yeah.
And that is even High Fleet Leviathan as well, because it's from the Leviathan campaign book.
Brilliant.
So if I take my initial 25 power, which was 2 tens of Gargoyles, some Flying Rippers, a Harpy and a Hive Crone, and I add another Harpy in there, and I add another 10 of Gargoyles, and I add my Hive Tyrant with wings. That's 46 power. So I just need to find something like, what else can fly? Maybe some... more importantly, what else is 4 power?
Yeah.
Venomthropes are 5. Zoanthropes are 7. Oh, the Red Terror. So that he's 3. I could give the Red Terror wings.
Wings for 1. Yeah, that'd be fine.
For 1. And that's my 50 power. Job done, Steve. Job done.
It would look so cool.
That would look pretty cool, wouldn't it? What would you do? What would you do next? Imagine if you could add a Harridan for 35 power. Boom. Suddenly we're at 84. We've got nearly a 2,000 point army on the go. Ideal. Absolutely ideal. Right. I think we need to stop there before I convince myself to buy 4,000 points worth of Tyranids. So hopefully you've enjoyed our little run through about this latest flashpoint. We may go back to the second flashpoint. What was it? The Book of Rust, and where was that set?
Caradon, wasn't it?
Yes, the Caradon section. That's right. Thanks, Steve. We probably won't go all the way back to Caradon, but we may, depending on the pace of releases for everything. But if you'd specifically like us to, do let us know. And if there's anything about this set of flashpoints that you really enjoyed, then do let us know. If you're building an army based on this thing, or if you've got any snow basing advice, then I'd love to hear from you, because I've never done snow bases before. And then finally, if there's something, there's a flashpoint that you'd like to see, or, you know, like a theme or a kind of theatre of war that you'd like a flashpoint to focus on in the future, a bit of wish listing, then, let us know. You can get a hold of us on ashesoftheimperium@gmail.com, or you can send us a voice note. We are on anchor.fm/AOTI40K. And then, of course, we are on Twitter @AOTI40K as well. And you can get us on Facebook by the same handle. So until next time, keep calm and crusade on.
Cheers, guys.